Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Larry Massett. Has this ever happened to you? You're out eating dinner with some friends at a restaurant. The bill comes, scribbled with a very faint pencil in Sanskrit. And now you have to try to figure out who owes what, the tip, and all that.
Let's see, 8 times 3 is 21, so if we add 10% to that...
No, you take the total, 72, and 15% of that is maybe $10 or $12, so...
You guys are just guessing. Let's do it right. 8 times 3 is 34.
It is not.
Yes, it is.
8 times 3 is 24.
You just said 21.
Well, you just said 34, and that's ridiculous.
I said I would change my mind every 2 seconds.
God, does anybody have a calculator?
Wait, I've got it. I'm shutting my eyes. I'm seeing 72 plus 10 minus 34 plus the square root of 3, square root of 3 plus 10 minus
right.
4 plus 21, 18,
kind of trance.
34, 16. The answer is we each owe $8,421. Well, it's true, you know. We're losing it. We're beginning to forget all those hours sweating through Ms. Grundy's math class, wrestling down the multiplication tables, the rules of long division, the whole great dismal swamp of math. It's all down the tube. Me, I don't mind. My math was only a bag of cheap tricks anyway. Learned it by rote, never knew what it meant, and if I now need a machine to figure out the tip, hey, why not? Indeed, maybe it's an opportunity. If we don't have to worry about getting the right answer anymore, the calculator hopefully will do that, then maybe we can start over. We can go back to the beginning. We can ask, what are numbers anyway? What is math? What, if anything, does it have to do with the real world? And above all, why does it work? Our show today is called From Here to Infinity. Picture the ocean and a beach somewhere in ancient Greece. White sand, blue water, olive trees on the hill. Men and women in long robes, barefoot. We're in the 5th or 6th century B.C. now. Men and women stroll up and down the beach, singing, playing instruments, chanting. This is a religious ceremony. It's a cult, a commune. These are the Pythagoreans. Here, they say, men and women live on equal terms, celibate, without property, without ambition. To live, for the Pythagoreans, is to contemplate. They contemplate the ultimate nature of reality. They believe in the transmigration of souls. They believe in many peculiar things.
Thou shalt not eat beans.
Thou shalt not eat beans.
Thou shalt not eat the flesh of the red mullet or of the black-tailed fish.
Thou shalt not eat the flesh of the red mullet or of the black-tailed fish.
Never look in a mirror that is next to a lamp.
Never look in a mirror that is next to a lamp.
Never let a swallow nest under your roof.
Never let a swallow nest under your roof.
Pythagoras has been called the first real mathematician in the history of the West. He's also been described as a total fruit. He wore a turban. He sat behind a screen so the common people couldn't see him, kind of like the Wizard of Oz. He is also said to have had a golden thigh. On occasion, he would lift his robe and display his golden thigh to the devotees. Golden-thighed Pythagoras, go figure.
When you cut your fingernails, always spit upon the trimmings.
When you cut your fingernails, always spit upon the trimmings.
When you travel far from home, don't look back.
When you travel far from home, don't look back.
Everything is number. All things are number.
Everything is number. All things are number. Everything is number. All things are number. Everything is number.
Now, when the Pythagoreans said everything is number, they meant everything. It was their fundamental doctrine. Justice is the number 4. Perfection is 10. 2 is female. The real world, rocks, trees, the sky, elephants, you and me, we are all number. This is not as dumb as it sounds. It kind of depends on how you picture a number. The Pythagoreans pictured a dot. Maybe this comes from counting the pebbles, who knows? A dot, a point in space, like an atom. In the beginning, they said, was the void, the unbounded, the infinite, the nothingness. Somehow out of the void comes the one. They don't explain how this happens, but hey, we don't explain the Big Bang either. It just happens. Out of the void comes the one, the first unit, the integer, the first thing with definite boundaries. It's like what we would call the number one, but it's also a thing in space, like an atom. Well, along comes the next one, and when you have two of them, you can draw a line. With three units, three ones, you can build a triangle, so you are now in the realm of two dimensions. With four dots, you make a pyramid, which takes you up into the three-dimensional world, and this is sort of like atoms hooking up to form molecules. This is literally how you construct the world. If you think about it, it's not that foolish. Sure, we can make fun of the Pythagoreans for going too far. They identified the odd numbers with the male and the sun and the mountains, and even numbers with the female, the moon, the valley, and some way they got from there to thou shalt not eat beans. But the basic insight that there is an order to the universe, that it is made up of building blocks, and that these building blocks, these elements, this order is profoundly connected to mathematics, hey, that's what scientists still believe.
Galileo said somewhere that the book of nature is an open book, but that book is written in the language of mathematics.
Jack Morava teaches math at the Johns Hopkins University.
It's open for anybody to read. You just have to know what questions you want to ask. It's not like a chess game where somebody's trying to mess you up. Nature won't play tricks on you. It'll answer your questions.
I think the question is, for me, I mean, I can buy the idea that nature is a book that happens mm-hmm. to be written in the language of math. But the question is, why? Why is it written in the language of math?
That's God's language. It seems to be an observable fact. This is the shorthand God uses when he writes messages to himself. I don't know how to answer that question, but it's certainly an observable fact. It's very, you can test it over, it's been tested thousands of times. That's what modern technology is based on.
The Pythagoreans thought that their numbers were physical things out there in the universe, and you could directly perceive them with your mind. Today, most people think that math is more like a game, an intellectual crossword puzzle.
Mathematics is like this big box of tools which are developed for very strange uses. Every once in a while you find some use for one of these tools, and when you do, you're really in business because you have this toolkit that's been cooked up by some very bright people.
That's funny. I have an image of a carpenter who starts by building tools and then mm-hmm. wonders if they can be used for anything.
Well, I had some friends in college who were interested in as a game in designing things like four-dimensional water pumps in case they ever happened to run into any four-dimensional water that they needed pumping. These were people in mechanical engineering, and they're quite interesting kind of problems, and they were good exercises in using your imagination as a mechanical engineer. Who knows? Maybe they should have patented these gadgets.
Some of the strangest unpatented gadgets to come out of the toolbox of modern math are George Cantor's transfinite numbers. You can understand them without doing any calculation, hardly. I can understand them. Believing in them is something else. It brings up again the question of whether math is out there in the world or just in our heads.
George Cantor was a German mathematician who, in the late 19th century, was the first person to really define infinity. Up until then, we all thought infinity was just bigger than anything we could imagine.
This is Michael Gillen. He teaches math and physics at Harvard. He's science correspondent for ABC.
George Cantor basically asked us to consider the following. He asked us to consider all the whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And he made the point that you never reach an end to these numbers. And to some degree, that defined for him and for the rest of us for all time an infinity. Most people would have stopped there, but he didn't. He said, I'm not satisfied with this infinity alone. Let's now consider all the possible combinations of numbers that one can create from this infinity of whole numbers. So, for example, you can combine 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 3 and 6, 7 and 8, so forth. You can glean from this infinity of whole numbers a large number of pairs of numbers. The question became, how many pairs of numbers could you create from this infinity of whole numbers? George Cantor was the first to answer that question, and the answer was amazing. He discovered that the answer to that question is it's a number greater than infinity. And you say, what can be greater than infinity? This is crazy. I thought infinity was the greatest thing you could imagine. Cantor discovered, no, it's not. There is something that he calls transfinite numbers, numbers that are bigger than infinity.
Cantor called the infinity of whole numbers Aleph zero, or Aleph null, Aleph being the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. The next infinity, the bigger one, he called Aleph 1. The way you can get from Aleph null to Aleph 1 is very simple as far as the math goes. It's almost too easy.
Well, let me try to explain. Let's take a simple set of numbers like 1, 2, and 3. All right, and you ask yourself, how many combinations of two numbers can you create from that set of three numbers? And you're going to find that the answer is 2 to the third power, which is 2 times 2 times 2, which is, by my reckoning, 8. You can pair off 1 and 2, 2 and 3, 1 and 3, 3 and 1, 3 and 2, 2 and 1, and so forth. You get 8 combinations, or 8 permutations, as we would say. What he found was that if you now take an infinity of numbers, like the whole numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, all the way out to infinity, and you ask the question, how many pairs of numbers can you glean from that? The answer is 2 to the infinity. And the clearly, 2 to the infinity is a much bigger than number than just infinity alone.
You can use the same mathematical trick, making combinations of the numbers, to get from Aleph 1 to Aleph 2, Aleph 3, 4, and so on all the way to Aleph infinity. Now, the Alephs, the transfinite numbers, are supposed to be numbers, just like 7 and 8, except, of course, they have some truly weird features.
For example, take the Aleph null, the infinity which represents the whole numbers. If you take, let's say, some subset of the whole numbers, let's consider, let's say, just the even numbers, and you ask the question, how many even numbers are there? You're going to be tempted to say that it's half the number of whole numbers, right? Because only every other number is even. Every other number is odd. So if you only consider the even numbers, you're tempted to think that there is only half the number of infinity. It's not true. It's still Aleph zero. In other words, one of the properties of these transfinite numbers is that they are as large as their own subsets. The subset of Aleph null, the even numbers, is as large as the whole numbers. They're both inexhaustible. They're both infinity. It's bizarre.
And the more you explore the transfinite, the more bizarre it gets. Are you willing to believe, for instance, that the number of points on a 1-inch line is exactly the same as the number of points on a 10-foot line? It violates common sense. In his own day, George Cantor was controversial. Even now, he is not considered orthodox by all mathematicians. At heart, the trouble with the Alephs, these transfinite numbers, is that they are all collections of numbers. They are sets, as the mathematicians like to say, but they are not defined in the same way as ordinary sets.
Because remember, in mathematics, we define a set as something that can be bracketed. It's curly brackets. The numbers 1, 2, and 3 are a three-element set, and they're bracketed by curly brackets. How in the world do you begin to imagine that you're bracketing something that has an infinite number of elements? The way George Cantor got around that is that he wrote the set curly bracket, 1, 2, 3, ... those ... implying that some infinite number of elements were to follow. And then he closed it off with a curly bracket. And it's those three dots, the ellipses, that many mathematicians to this day still have a problem accepting as a legitimate definition of a set.
Well, how do you define a set? If you feel that you can write down a set ending in ... then the transfinite falls in your lap. If you don't agree, no one can make you. This seems to be a dispute about the rules of the game. Hey, if it's just a game, if math is a game, hey, you could define a set as a little red fish with wings.
There are a lot of mathematicians who think that mathematics is merely a kind of a game of the mind, that when you sit there doing mathematics, you're really just playing games with thoughts, much as people will play games with words doing a crossword puzzle. And sometimes those words converge to create a beautiful pattern, much as in the case of mathematics, those thoughts converge into a beautiful mathematical theory. I think it's a game to some degree. But if it were merely a game, and if it were merely that arbitrary, why is it that mathematics describes the real world so well? Now, you can chalk that up as mere coincidence. And you might also point out, as some mathematicians do, that mathematics doesn't always describe the real world. So, hey, what's the mystery here? The fact is that mathematics, even in its most abstract forms, even when you're dealing with creations which were never meant to apply to the real world, often do, more often than not. Let me give you an example of what I mean. When mathematicians discovered negative numbers, there was no thought at that time that negative numbers corresponded to anything real. They were, at that time, considered to be really just interesting products of the mathematical imagination. But it was in the 1930s when a mathematician named Paul Dirac took a chance in thinking that negative numbers might correspond to objects that have negative energies. And he called these objects antimatter or antiparticles. And it was shortly thereafter that he discovered that, sure enough, antiparticles do exist. It suddenly made you realize that those inventions of the mathematical imagination may not be mere figments of an over-creative imagination, but they may be ways of perceiving reality. In this case, the mathematicians who invented negative numbers may have been perceiving in their own way antiparticles without realizing it. I know it sounds weird.
Not only does it sound weird, it sounds Greek. It begins to sound like the Pythagoreans. Remember? They believed that numbers were really out there in the physical world and all we had to do was perceive them. Well, says Michael Gillen, maybe so.
You have to remember that it was Plato who first came up with the notion of the principle of plenitude, it's called, which stated basically that everything and anything of the human imagination corresponded to something real in the world, in the universe, even though it may not have yet been discovered. Now, a lot of people have never taken that principle very seriously because they say, look, you mean that if I imagine a winged horse or a mermaid or some little green man, that in fact you're telling me that such things actually exist somewhere in the universe and they just merely need to be discovered? Well, Plato would have said, yeah. I would say maybe in that case. I would say that maybe those far-out things exist and maybe they don't. Maybe they're mere illusions being played on our sense of imagination. I nonetheless believe that imagination, our imagination, is a sixth sense by which we perceive reality. And I find proof of that in mathematics because so many outrageous ideas created by mathematicians, closeted away in their office, who didn't give a hoot about the real world, ended up describing the real world to a T.
Well, speaking as a mathophobe, speaking as a person who flunked plane geometry, a man who has forgotten the multiplication tables, I don't mind if math describes the real world, so long as it only describes a part of the world, leaving alone real people and passions, dogs and rose gardens. Yet Michael Gillen, speaking as a mathematician, and perhaps at heart a Pythagorean, dreams of expanding the kingdom of math.
You know, I think to most people, mathematics is arithmetic, it's logic, it's something with which you can prove something to be absolutely true or false. And mathematics is that, but it's so much more. And one of the exciting things about mathematics is over the last century especially, it's gone well beyond mere arithmetic and mere logic, at least mere Aristotelian logic. And one of the things that it promises to do is to expand its ability to describe more and more and more of the universe. Let me give you an example of what I mean. According to Aristotelian logic, something is either true or it's false. There's nothing in between. It's what's called the principle of the excluded middle. What we're discovering now is that there are logical systems, other than Aristotle's original one, which provide for a middle, a kind of a maybe, so that in these systems, which are called trivalent logical systems, something can be true, it can be false, and it can be maybe. This is further leading into multivalent logical systems, which are not only just three, give you three different possibilities, but an infinite number of possibilities, and they're what's called fuzzy logical systems, and you're hearing more and more about that. Fuzzy logical systems encompass the possibility that something is neither true nor false, but is somewhere in an infinite number of shades of gray in between. And that's creating a major revolution in mathematics. One of the things that I look into the future, I mean, we can speak about how well mathematics helps explain the real world right now, but you just wait and see, because I think the future is in trying to marry up the current day mathematics, which is very good already, with the human sciences, with even the humanities. I believe that there exists an opportunity for us to incorporate all the uncertainties that embody the human experience and all the irrationalities that embody the human experience with the wonderful rationalities that embody the mathematical experience. I think that's the future of mathematics. That's what I find so exciting.
Well, what do you think? Drop us a letter. Give us your opinion. Our show today, From Here to Infinity, was produced by myself, Larry Nassett, with special thanks to Jim and Gabriel Martino, Carolyn Hopewell, Paul Bishop, Kathy Schlegel, Big Blow and the Bushwhackers, Ted Watkin.
Hey, psst, mister.
Hey,
mister.
What? What do you want?
Mister, I want to show you a secret.
What?
Okay. I show you a secret way to multiply. A trick.
Oh, right. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like you to meet Peasant Lady. This is Peasant
yes,
Lady.
That's me.
And it's time for today's Soundprint Brain Teaser. You're going to need to look at your hands for this, so if you happen to be driving your car right now, don't. We're about to learn a bit of peasant mathematics. These are calculating tricks you can do on your hands. They have been found all over the Middle East and Europe. They probably date back to the Roman Empire, and they're quite useful for those awkward moments when your pocket calculator breaks down. Anyway, Peasant Lady will now show us how to multiply two numbers larger than five.
Okay, you pick. You pick the numbers. Two numbers.
Okay. Let's say 9 times 7. I want to multiply 9 times 7.
That's a good choice. That's a very good choice.
Okay.
You got two hands, okay? Your left hand, your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
The 9, because that's the number on the left, is going to go on your left hand.
Okay.
And the 7, that's the number on the right, it's going to go on your right hand, okay?
Yeah, I can handle that.
Okay, now. We start with your left hand.
Mm-hmm.
Look at your left hand. Tell me, how many fingers you see? Oh, no, don't be slow. You got five fingers. Normally, you got five fingers.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so you got five fingers. Okay, so you take five away from nine.
Four.
That's four. Okay, now, here's what you do. You fold over your four fingers.
Fold over four fingers.
Yeah, bend them on over here. That's right. Okay, very good. You're a smart boy. Now tell me what you see on your left hand.
Well, I just did it. I've got four fingers folded down and one finger sticking up.
That's right. That's right. Now, we're going to go to your right hand and we're going to do the same thing.
Okay, let's see. I was going to multiply 9 times 7, so the number on the right is 7.
You got five fingers, you take five away from 7, you get 2.
2, right.
So you fold over 2 fingers.
Okay. So on my right hand now, I've got 2 fingers folded down and 3 sticking up. And on my left hand, I've got 4 fingers down and 1 sticking up.
That's good. Yeah. You catch on very quick. Now here's the secret. Here's what you're going to do. You look at your folded down fingers.
Okay, yeah, 4 on the left, 2 on the right.
And you add them up. Can you do that? You can add them up?
Yeah, 4, 2, 6.
That's right, wonderful, 6. That's terrific. That's the first part of the answer is 6. Right, now don't forget the 6.
Okay.
So now you look at your sticking up fingers. What do you see?
I see 1 finger sticking up on my left hand, 3 sticking up on my right hand. So what do I do?
You multiply.
Multiply.
You multiply the sticking up fingers.
Okay, 1 sticking up times 3 sticking up. That's 3.
That's right, that's right. 3, you're a genius. 3 is the second half of your answer. You already got a 6, now you got a 3. You put them together.
63.
That's right, 63, that's it. 7 times 9 is gonna be 63.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it works every time. What is the secret? Secret. Shh.
Well, there you have it. You can try this out with other numbers. They each have to be bigger than 5, but smaller than 10. You'll find it does work every time, just like the peasant lady said. The question is, why? That's our riddle. That's the contest for today. Figure out why it works, then write us no later than August 30. Write Brain Teaser, care of Soundprint, 2216 North Charles Street, Baltimore, Maryland, 21218. You can also reach us on internet. Our address there is soundprt, that's soundprt, at jhuvms.hcf.jhu.edu. If you didn't quite get that, you can give us a call at 410, area code 410-516-0833, and we'll set you straight. That's 410-516-0833. All the correct answers, as judged by the ambidextrous Soundprint staff, will go into a hat from which 5 lucky winners will be pulled at random. Winners win a subscription to The Sciences, the cultural magazine of science, where science and art meet, bringing you new ideas illuminated by the visual arts. The Sciences, published by the New York Academy of Sciences. Soundprint is technical producer Anna Maria De Freitas, senior producer Nina Ellis, researcher Debbie Morris, and studio engineer Robin Wise. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Larry Massey. Soundprint is produced at the Johns Hopkins University with support from the National Science Foundation and radio station WETA-FM in Washington, D.C. Additional support for this program is provided by this and other National Public Radio member stations, and the NPR Information Fund, whose contributors include the Eaton Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.